Have you heard of Qwirt? It's the fully async version of Flask, created by Philip Jones, who's working closely with the Flask team on these parallel projects. The TLDR version is that if you want to take advantage of async and await and you're using Flask, you want to give Qwirt a solid look. We've spoken to Philip previously about Qwirt. This time around, he's here to share his top Qwirt extensions and libraries that you can adopt today. This is Talk Python to Me, episode 452, recorded January 10th, 2024. Welcome to Talk Python to Me, a weekly podcast on Python. This is your host, Michael Kennedy. Follow me on Mastodon, where I'm at mkennedy, and follow the podcast using at talkpython, both on bostodon.org. Keep up with the show and listen to over 7 years of past episodes at talkpython.fm. We've started streaming most of our episodes live on YouTube. Subscribe to our YouTube channel over at talkpython.fm/YouTube to get notified about upcoming shows and be part of that episode. This episode is sponsored by Posit Connect from the makers of Shiny. Publish, share, and deploy all of your data projects that you're creating using Python. Streamlit, Dash, Shiny, Bokeh, FastAPI, Flask, Quattro, reports, dashboards, and APIs. Posit Connect supports all of them. Try Posit Connect for free by going to talkpython.fm/posit, P-O-S-I-T. And it's also brought to you by us over at TalkPython Training. Did you know that we have over 250 hours of Python courses? Yeah, that's right. Check him out at talkpython.fm/courses. Philip, welcome back to Talk Python to Me. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for the invite.
We're going to talk about web things. I love some web things. We're going to talk about async. I love async. And we're going to talk about a lot of little cool things you can plug into your web apps that make them more awesome. And we give a lot of people a lot of things to think about. So yeah, let's do it. So I guess quickly before we get into talking about Qwirt, maybe a little catch up on where it's been since the last time we spoke about that. Give folks a bit of background on yourself for who don't know you.
Sure, yeah. I guess probably in this context, and maybe the people listening, I'm probably known for Qwirt and Hypercorn and helping maintain the Palettes libraries like Flask and Virksook. But outside of that, I guess in my professional career, I work as a software engineer in London. I work for a company called Curaleaf International, and quite interestingly, because it's not very well known, we're one of the few companies that do medical cannabis in the UK. Not many people know it's legal.
Yeah, interesting.
Put on that aside, so I've worked there for about a year and a bit now. Before that, worked at various other software firms. And then before that, I was actually a particle physicist working on an experiment out in Canada in a deep mine, which was quite good fun.
So you like your variety of your jobs, I can tell.
Yeah, I had a definite career shift.
Indeed. Just a funny sidebar, you know, cannabis was legalized here 3 or 4 years ago in Oregon. There are more cannabis shops than there are Starbucks, than there are McDonald's. Like,
oh wow,
I could walk to 4 from my house in 5 minutes. It's nuts. Anyway, it's very different than it was a few years ago for sure. It's all fine, but just different. All right. So Qwirt, like Flask, kind of, but very interesting. It's got some other capabilities. Tell people about Qwirt. How does it relate to Flask? There's a lot of crossover. You and David Lord are working pretty closely, it seems like, on things these days.
I started Qwirt about, I guess, 7, maybe a bit more years ago now. And the original idea was make Flask async. At the time, I couldn't figure out how to adapt Flask at all in that direction. So I thought, okay, I'll start by just re-implementing the Flask API using async await. And that's what Qwirt started out to be. Over the years, David and I have worked to try and merge the two together. So the very latest change that's happened a few months ago is we actually based Qwirt on Flask now. So there's a lot of shared code now. And for a long time, Qwirt was based on Virksook. And if you're familiar with the Palettes and Flask ecosystem, Flask is built on Virksook and Qwirt was, but now Qwirt is built on Flask, which is built on Virksook, and they're very, very similar.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Because the more that you can share, like the more you all can just focus on features and making it better rather than duplicating that effort.
The over aim is that the APIs are the same as they can be other than async await. So you can take your Flask code base and move to Qwirt just by adding async await. That's the dream, even closer than it's ever been to that now.
You're pretty close to being able to rename the word Flask, keeping the case sensitivity intact from blast the court and it works, right?
Yeah, in simple projects. Yeah, the more complicated ones, it comes down to the extensions, which we're going to talk about.
Yeah, that's the whole topic of today, right?
Yes, exactly. But yeah, that's the aim. Our long-term aim is to actually merge the two and be able to say async Flask. Well, it's kind of the case now where you can say async Flask is Quart, and we can't quite do what Django's done and put async Django as it is in Django. Ours, you have to make a naming choice from the start. But yeah, I think it's getting as close as we can get. Maybe we'll figure out how to merge them in the future, hopefully.
Yeah, it'd be great if it just you could choose to use async def or just regular functions for your views in Flask and not really think about it.
You can't do that now.
Okay.
You've been able to do that for about 2 years, I think, trying to figure out when we merge that. So you could use either. It's just not as performant. If your code base is going to be mostly async, you probably want to switch to Quart fully because it'd be more performant and more reliable and robust.
Sure. Why is that?
The Flask implementation will run your async code on a separate thread. So you get all that overhead of switching between the threads, sending the information over and back, etc.
Right. Does it run like an async IO event loop on the other thread, but then wait, basically curry the results back and forth?
Yep.
And with Quart, it's running right on top of an ASCII server.
Yep.
Straight, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's super cool. And you might be responsible for one of the more prominent ones out there. Tell people about, well, what is an ASCII server for people who don't know? Why does it exist? And then, you know, the one that you got.
Yeah, sure. So historically, there was the WSGI standard, which separated servers from frameworks applications and kind of gave you a choice between how do you want to serve and deal with concurrency and stuff? And then how do you want your API to build your apps, the framework to be? I think it was a great choice because it made the ecosystem really, really nice for developers. And ASCII is the same thing for async. And so Quart is an example of an ASCII framework, and Hypercon is an ASCII server. They originally together, much like Sanic, started out as well, but then I split that out Hypercon into its own thing. And then later on, now Hypercon is also a WSGI server. So yeah, in some respects, Hypercon is just a general purpose server for Python.
And so Hypercon, it lives in the same general usage base as GUnicorn and MicroWSGI, UWSGI. Right. So I could run it in production in it kind of like a overseer mode where you can fan out process worker processes and system daemon, system D, all that. That where it's at?
Yeah, it's exactly like that. Yeah. Yeah. And it also in the ASCII space, it's similar to UVCorn or Daphne. That's it.
Right.
I think there's another, but I've forgotten the name just now.
Yeah, I was just messing with some Docker stuff and I was running the web app, a fast API app, NG Unicorn using UVicorn workers, so handling the ASGI stuff that way. Is it better to use Hypercon? Is it rather than something along those lines? A little more direct, maybe? Or what do you think?
I think it's a bit of a choice. So how it differs from UVicorn in general is quicker because it's HTTP parser. HTTP/1 parser is quicker. And there's a few other choices that tend to make it a bit quicker. However, at least last time I checked, UVicorn doesn't support as many extensions as Hypercon, and it doesn't support HTTP/2 or HTTP/3. Now, most people don't actually serve that directly. They tend to have a load balancer in front, but right. I tend to do that because it's quite exciting. So you're getting there with Hypercon. And then after that, it's a bit of a choice between, you know, what features do they both have, what do you want to use? So they're fairly similar, I would say.
Sure. Okay, somewhat. Up to you what you want to choose, but for people who have mental models, maybe using UVicorn, they could check out Hypercon, right?
Yeah. So you wouldn't need GUnicorn because Hypercon has the process model that GUnicorn adds to UVicorn. And yeah, you can just switch over. It should be a one-liner because most of the time it's just that one command line where you set this up, right? So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very exciting. I'm going to give it a solid look because I'm deep in that world right now playing with things, which is very exciting, but not the topic for today. So the topic for today is people who are interested in doing Flask and Quart, especially Quart, what are ways you can do more, right? So the frameworks are pretty simple, right? That's of all the different APIs out there, the Flask API has definitely won. You know, even though there's many different web frameworks, right? If you look at the way programming works, you look at Fast API, you look at a Lightstar, many of these things, it's like you got to create a thing called app and then you say app.get and so on, right? So this style of programming is really popular. And I think it's because it's just straightforward and simple. Opposite of Django, maybe. Not so many batteries included, but you can add the batteries through extensions, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's always been the trade-off between Django and Flask and perhaps even Django and Quart, if you were to go Quart, is you Django makes the choice of your batteries to a large extent, whereas quart and flask means you have to choose, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is really nice if you got like, you know, like I would really rather use this graph database for this thing. And I would really rather, you know, like you get a lot of choice, but you have to kind of have to build a little bit more yourself and you've got to decide more yourself. So, but with all these extensions, it starts to become easier to click the Lego blocks back together. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. So if you go, people listening, go to quart.palettesproject.com and go in there and find the extensions. Here's a great long list of extensions that we've got here that they can choose to run, right? And how to do that and so on. But you picked out a couple that you really want to highlight and we'll dive into them. And if there's extra time, maybe we can, you know, pick some more out of the list and just see what we can make of them.
I think the best one to start with is the bit of discussion around an extension called Quart Flask Patch, which is a bit of a odd name and I maybe need to think of a better name for it. But the idea behind this extension is it patches quart import time to look very much like flask, so you can use some flask extensions directly.
Okay.
So this is again the idea to make it easier if you are so willing to transfer from flask to quart. This would allow you to an easier step because you could add this one line in quart flask patch and some of your flask extensions would just work now you've changed to quart.
That's awesome because yeah, there's a bunch out there. So what happens when I run this? Does it basically say like, okay, there's a bunch of module namespaces called quart this, quart that. Let's create proxies called flask that just delegate into the quart elements and expose that back. So code written against flask dot whatever, I think it still exists.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. It does slightly more because what it also needs to do is because a lot of the quart APIs are async, it needs to wrap them in a wrapper that allows it to be called synchronously, but it needs to do so in a nested sense. And in it, I don't know whether you've looked much into like nesting event loops in one another that, or getting back to the same event loop. It's a bit of a, yeah, I think it's fair maybe to call it a bit of a hack, but it does work well enough to give you, to allow you to buy that time to develop on. But that's what it has to do, yeah.
Yeah, I really wish that Python had an ambient event loop that was the default. This like, get me an event loop. Oh, it doesn't exist, an exception. Oh, create an event loop. Sorry, exception, it already exists. Like, you know, there's like, it's just really tricky to figure out kind of deep down in some library, like, well, am I in charge of this? Is it already going and I got to be part of something bigger? If you could just say, just async run this, you know, and just you do that. You need to make an event loop, make it. If you don't need to make one, just put it in the one that's already there, right? Like, I really wish there was a little bit cleaner story there, but you know, we're not going to solve that with quart extensions.
No. I mean, if they had have done that, it would have made making Flask async a lot easier. You've probably come across the library. I think it's Greenback.
Greenback? No, this is new.
Greenback is a greenlit like stack switcher based library that allows you to get back to the event loop when you're deep in some sync code, which is quite nice in the sense that, you know, it allows you to do all the stuff that's difficult. But it's not so nice in that it's kind of hidden in a way, monkey patching type stuff going on in the background.
Yeah.
I think this is what SQL Alchemy uses to get their async await support in. So it's certainly, I guess, popular. Yeah.
Sure. Re-enter async IO or trio event loops from synchronous code. Very nice. Cool. Okay. So Flask patch, that's pretty good if you just have some Flask code and you're like, oh, I want to switch to quart, but hopefully nothing changes and I'll just run this at the beginning and everything will work. How often does it work out to be easy like that?
So it depends on what the extension does. So if the extension does its own IO or calls certain Flask functions that this extension can't patch, then yeah, it just fails. And so not all of them. If you go into tests, you can see an example of some of them that we test against, just to make sure they work.
Like login potentially?
Yeah, so login is probably the most popular, I think. So I don't think it works for SQL Alchemy, for example. There's a technical example, anywhere that uses app context in a contact manager in a synchronous location, basically that's too hard to patch, so they tend to all fail. But yeah, a few do, and I hope it makes it easier for people. I'm pretty sure it is used because I get bug reports, so some people find it useful at least.
Yeah. Absolutely. It looks excellent, right? So once you do all the magic, you can just work with the login manager and off it goes, right?
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah.
Super cool. This portion of Talk Python to Me is brought to you by Posit, the makers of Shiny, formerly RStudio, and especially Shiny for Python. Let me ask you a question. Are you building awesome things? Of course you are. You're a developer or a data scientist. That's what we do. And you should check out Posit Connect. Posit Connect is a way for you to publish, share, and deploy all the data products that you're building using Python. People ask me the same question all the time. Michael, I have some cool data science project or notebook that I built. How do I share it with my users, stakeholders, teammates? Do I need to learn FastAPI or Flask or maybe Vue or React.js? Hold on now. Those are cool technologies, and I'm sure you'd benefit from them, but maybe stay focused on the data project. Let Posit Connect handle that side of things. With Posit Connect, you can rapidly and securely deploy the things you build in Python. Streamlit, Dash, Shiny, Bokeh, FastAPI, Flask, Quarto, ports, dashboards, and APIs. Posit Connect supports all of them. And Posit Connect comes with all the bells and whistles to satisfy IT and other enterprise requirements. Make deployment the easiest step in your workflow with Posit Connect. For a limited time, you can try Posit Connect for free for 3 months by going to talkpython.fm/posit. That's talkpython.fm/POSIT. The link is in your podcast player show notes. Thank you to the team at Posit for supporting TalkPython. Cores. Everybody loves their cross-site origin scripting restrictions. I guess we do love it in the sense that we're not getting our bank account stolen when we browse the web. But as a web developer, you're like, oh, cores again. I need to allow this thing to talk to that, but it's, you know, right? It can be a hassle. And so I'm guessing cores allows you to control those settings and expose them and so on.
Yeah, exactly that. I think it's become more prevalent, right, since the switch to kind of front-end frameworks has been so popular, right? Because you end up serving them, well, typically you end up serving them separately. But yeah, it's exactly as you describe. You can put decorators on routes, or you can put it on a blueprint or on the entire app, and you just say this is a cores policy for everything. Yeah, very similar to Flask cores, but different API.
So you can put it on even like a blueprint and say this whole section of code is where the APIs live. Things can call that, but nothing else. That's really nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it also has a slight web, because obviously Quart does WebSockets, whereas Flask at least natively can't. But yeah, there's some WebSocket considerations for Quart as well, which mostly come around to checking the origin header. But yeah, it does that as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you have a route and you just put the @route_cores on it, or like you said, a blueprint or on the whole app or however you want. But and then what kind of arguments does it take? What can I ask it? Make it do.
Yeah, so I went for the kind of, I guess, functional kind of API for it. So you can put in like the allow headers, or what's the other one, the credentials, I forget what it's called now, but they're all listed and they're all keyword arguments effectively to it. There was in the issues, someone a couple of maybe last year put out a suggestion for a new API for cores libraries that would be more intuitive but wouldn't match the actual headers that came out. So at some point I hope to like look into that and offer that as well. But at the moment you basically say the header and then the values you want. So it's very, you have to really kind of know cores to use it.
Okay. It just basically juggles the headers and there's not a lot of abstractions in between.
No. So I think in the README, it shows you them all actually. So these are all the headers you can control, and it's basically the same name.
Sure. So access control, allow origin, access control, allow credentials, expose headers, max age, all these things that you might want to use, right? Yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, you have types as well. No, that's lovely. Are you a fan of types, type hints?
Since it came out, I've tried not to write untyped code, I think, especially in a team. I think it makes a huge difference to the like understanding of the code. So yeah, I'm a very big fan.
Yeah, I also think it makes your editors help you more. You know, if it knows what type that is and you say dot, is this what you meant? Like, yes, actually, I didn't know that existed, but that's what I want. Give that to me. Without types, you're kind of like, well, you know, you get object or weird, useless stuff that you can't do anything with. All right. So cores, if you need to do cores, there's, I guess, let me know how true this is, but I think pretty much most of these that exist, there's probably a Flask variant. So if you use Flask and you're like, oh, I need cores, but I don't use Quart, just Flask-cores instead of Quart-cores.
Yeah. I think it's quite well maintained, the Flask one. So yeah, the Flask cores, it's slightly different API, but the concepts are all the same, obviously. So yeah, not very much.
Another one is auth means so many different things. Is it session type based auth? Is it OAuth? Is it who knows what, YubiKeys, what are we talking here?
Yeah, session management via a secure cookie. So it's a similar usage as if you're familiar with Flask login, but I didn't want to call it court login because it didn't really do anything with the login. It didn't check the password or the username or an MFA or anything to do with login, in my opinion. So I called it auth instead. But yeah, so with this extension, you tell it to log in a user and give it some kind of identifier, and it saves that information securely in a cookie for you. And whenever the user comes back and presents the cookie, it then pulls it out and turns it into what is called the current user. So you'll be, I think it's called the current user in Flask login as well. So very similar to that.
All right. So you get this auth user back. What is this auth user? It's not like out of your database, right? It's some, it has properties. But
by default, it just has a method to say whether the user is authenticated and to return their ID. But if you customize it, if you extend it, so what I typically do in my code base is I extend it and I add methods to return the model from the database, for example.
Yeah, very cool. Nice. And, you know, there's a lot of fancy login off stuff, but nice session cookie. You know, it just works these days. It still works really well.
It does, yeah. Much simpler than JDBTs and less likely to go wrong, I think.
It's not exactly related, but I've had a lot of websites now have given up on passwords, but they don't use something newer. They just decided, like, every time you want to get to the site, you just, we're going to email you a code and you enter it. When did that become the way we're going to log into everything? It's driving me crazy. So some good old username, password, we're going to store your ID in a cookie. It warms the heart.
Bit off topic, but I've been playing with the web auth and little USB keys and such recently. I quite like it. I think it might be a bit complex still. It's a little tricky to get working, but yeah, I think that's probably the future, to be honest with you.
The site just sees, like, yeah, you got the right hardware thing. Off we go. Computer knows you're there, something like that, right?
Yeah.
Nice. Okay, so people need to deal with users. This is not about storing them in the database, encrypting, hashing their passwords, or those types of algorithms. It's really just about the web browser exchange that involves setting a cookie when you're logged in and getting it back and make sure it's not tampered with, right?
Yeah, yeah. So what it does is it stores the value, like the number 2 is the ID for the user. So it stores that in the cookie in plain text, but then cryptographically signs it. So you don't want to store anything sensitive in the cookie if you're worried about it being read, but you can store identifiers, et cetera, and know that it hasn't been tampered with.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not going to harm you to know that your user ID is 2 or 75117 or whatever. But if it's 2, was to stop somebody from going, let me change that to a 3 and see what happens. Oh, look, I'm an admin. How cool is that? Right. That's the problem that you're trying to solve with secure, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, from my side, I baked that thing in myself, but having a extension that just does it, that sounds better.
Yeah. So the nice thing, well, the bit I took a bit of interest, I think it's changed now with Flask login, but a couple of the areas where I wanted to improve is it does same site settings on the cookie by default. So it will start with the strict, and then you can play around and go down to lax if you so need. But it also has the special host, you know, the double underscore host prefixes on the name and stuff
right,
like
yeah.
that. So although I don't think in reality that adds that much to your security, but it's a kind of a safety net in some respects.
Yeah. Sometimes also it becomes a hassle when you're doing development because your host is localhost and you're saying it has to be, you know, mysite.com. You're like, well, I can't log in anymore. So then you've got to have localhost, and then I don't know. It doesn't feel super tamper resistant to me either. Are you familiar with SecurePy? There we go. This is an interesting project too.
Oh, it's been archived.
Oh, it's archived. Oh, sadly. Is there a new one? No, but I think it still works. I'm not sure what been deprecated. Okay, well, I guess that's not being used as well, that or used that much. But it used to be a way to kind of set all those different things, I believe. Or is this a different? This is a totally different.
Yeah, I think this is, I thought you were going to say secure headers, I think, or something. Is it called that?
Oh, I think it's just called secure, what it is. Yeah, that's the one. So sorry, that was some other random thing that we found that was called SecurePy, but not, this thing is still alive and supports court, which is why I brought it up amongst like lots of other frameworks. But yeah, you were going to tell people about this. This is cool.
Yeah, yeah. So I pretty much end up adding all of these by hand. So yeah, you most of the headers you want to add. And if you ever do a pen test, right, they're going to, if you don't have these headers by default, that's going to be a finding straight away. So yeah, it just adds all the ones you want, really.
Right. For one of the ones that you might not think of that you should probably have, unless you have a really specific use case, is what if somebody created a site you know, you had service.com and they had service.io or, you know, whatever, and they bought that. And then they could put your, whatever their URL is, your, it just into your site as a 100% width and height iframe, right? And then they just capture all the keystrokes. Like, huh, you're typing into your thing. It looks like your thing. Your data is there. You don't want people to do that to your site or just randomly host your site in their site. So for example, this secure thing will set X frame options to same origin. So you can't embed. Your site can no longer be embedded by default. You got to choose to let it be embedded. All those kinds of things, right, are really nice here.
I actually got caught out by that many, many years ago. I built an image photo editor in the browser.
Oh, cool.
It started to get quite a lot of use. And I was like, oh, this is great. And then I realized it was on somebody else's domain, basically in an iframe. So
they're like, look at our amazing editor that we're getting Google AdWord money for or whatever, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So a little bit of header action will shut that stuff down. But I mean, I didn't know to do it until I kind of dug into it more, right? Or you find out your site somewhere else.
I think it's like a lot of it seems to be, yeah, learned with experience, I guess, isn't it? Or on the job.
It only happens once when you see your web app in somebody else's site embedded as an iframe. You're like, no, this is not going to be okay. Awesome. All right. So that was court auth as well as the secure thing. Next, I guess kind of related to security, maybe not exclusively, but somewhat, rate limiting.
Yeah, because I mean, on a login route, you'd want to put a rate limiter on straight away to stop any kind of brute forcing anyway, right? So.
Oh, absolutely. And the ability to do really nice rate limiting in ways that punish the rate limit breaker is so much easier on async things like court, right? Because if you don't want to be overwhelmed by them, a lot of times you just say, you send them some kind of response code. I don't know what the status code is, like too many requests or something, like some 400.
429.
There you go. So you can just send them back straight away, but there's no cost for them to receive that 429. You know, they're just like super quick going. If you want to say, like, because maybe they're trying to guess passwords or something, you're like, let's not let them guess so quickly. So you could like sleep and then respond to them in 10 seconds later. So it's like, oh, well, I don't know. Is the password good or not? Why don't you wait around for a while instead of going somewhere else? With a async IO based website, that's await async.io.sleep, nearly zero cost to you other than maybe an open socket. And you can just like send them to sort of time black holes super easy. Whereas like a WSGI app, you're blocking a request and you can only handle so many and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, so this one sadly doesn't do any of that fun.
It doesn't have punishment built into it. No, but tell us about how it works, what it does.
I was going to say, I think there was an article today suggesting you should serve zip bombs or something to like unpleasant requesters, but yeah, it doesn't do any of that.
Send them like 100 gigs back or something. Yeah, it's good, that'd be good. That would be good, actually.
Yeah, so this one implements rate limiting as it's defined. Like a user would be allowed to do so many requests in a certain time, and also implements the RFC for the like headers that you're supposed to send back when they go over the rate limit, so they know when they can or when the client can then request again.
I see. Like you've made too many, rather than just saying too many requests, try again later. You're like, and you'll be reset in 5 minutes, or like there's a proper way to communicate that.
The thing I find really interesting about this, which I don't know if everyone does, but I'll say anyway, but most people implement rate limiting like a leaky bucket or something like that. These are the standard algorithms. And typically that requires you to store two variables per key, per rate limit you're looking at. But there's I think it's not a very well known algorithm called the generic cell rate algorithm. I think that's right. And this allows you to store one algorithm one variable per rate limit, and it's really quite nice. The algorithm, it's very, when you get it, it's really intuitive and clean. You basically, what you store is when you expect the next request to arrive, and if the request arrives too early, then you just rate limit it. And yeah, it's really clever, I think. So I'd like more people to know about it, basically, because it's a really nice solution.
It's a great solution. Yeah, so this, it doesn't slow them down, it just tells them that they've gone over the limit in this particular one, right? It's not like if you expect it to be in 5 seconds, you don't just sleep for four and then let it in.
No. So the idea is that this decorator is much less costly in terms of your compute than your function, your handler. So this decorator will just send back a 429 very quickly and never touch your route instead.
Okay, interesting. I'm starting to think about maybe if you have async and await available and your algorithm told you when the next one was coming, you could just sleep them until the next one's allowed, potentially, if it wasn't 10 minutes, right?
That would be the client I mean, it depends on your rate limits, but there's a good chance the client would time out, right? So
right. It'd have to be like 5 seconds or something real short, right? Like I don't want more than one request a second type of rate limiting, not like 5 per hour. Then they would definitely time out. But yeah, there's a lot of things you can do with this. So basically the way it works for people listening is you can set it up on the app. So the entire app itself, all the requests to it are limited, right? Or you can go and put kind of like tenacity. You can put the decorator exactly on a particular endpoint and then set the details for that one, right?
Yep. So a bit like Cause, you can do it per app, per blueprint, or per route, depending on what you need.
Okay. And here you say rate limit one and then a time delta. What's the one?
It's the count. So you might want, so for a rate of 1 per second, you might want to express that as 10 per 10 seconds. So it would be instead of the one, the 10. And that allows you a bit of bursting, if you will. So, you know, that 10 can come in 1 second or they can be spread over. So yeah, it allows you to express the rate limits in different ways, really.
Guessing this probably bypasses the static files. Is that true?
If you do the default limits, I think that applies to static files as well. I can't remember now, but I think that's what
it does. Might have, you know, 6 CSS files, 20 images, and so on, right? And like one page request might blast those all back super quick.
Yeah. You certainly want a higher limit.
Yeah. But presumably you're using something like Nginx or whatever, or maybe even a CDN. And then all those other things I described don't actually go through the Python app, ideally.
Yeah. I mean, it does work if you do it for the Python app as well. So up to you, I think. Yeah.
Indeed. All right. WT Forms. Next up, Court WTF. What is this?
So this was, I'm tempted to say it's been a bit less popular recently with the front-end frameworks and stuff. But when you did template rendering, you'd render the form, and then you do the validation in your Python framework for that form, and you pass back the errors. And basically, it would the WTF framework would do a lot of that for you. So you could just put in, like in your template, an input box, and it would do the errors and do the, like you can see here, you could do the CSRF tokens and render all the HTML for the labels and the actual input boxes and get it all hooked up very easily. And that's what it does. Yeah, it does all that. And the validation when it comes to the backend as well, I think you can just do form.validate on submit or something like that. Yeah, there we are. And that's it. That's your whole validation. So saves a lot of effort, really.
Yeah, that's pretty handy. And I'm guessing you're getting generally generic HTML out on the client side, so you can CSS style it up all you like.
Yeah, I think it's, I can't remember exactly. I think WTF might have hooks so you can put styling directly in. But yeah, it's pretty pretty generic as I remember it.
Yeah, some frameworks require explicit stuff on, say, the input box, you know, like form-control would be Bootstrap and things like that, right? There's probably some way to set a class.
Yeah, I think there's a class name argument. I'm trying to, I may have misremembered that. I think it was called class name.
Yeah, sure. Nice. Yeah, I haven't used this really, but I've used it kind of like it in other frameworks. In the end, I ended up just going back to writing my own HTML because I felt like I was getting 60% help, but maybe 30% struggle to fight the system. You know what I mean? And then I'm like, all right, you know what? I just know this stuff well enough. I'm just going to do it myself. But if you don't want to mess with it, you want it, some sort of quick development type of thing, or maybe you're not super familiar with HTML, this will definitely help, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I think you can also write your own HTML instead and just let it do the Python validation part.
Oh, right. As long as it lines up. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I think it's just the name that matters. Like your input has to have the right name.
Yeah. Because otherwise, how would it know, right? It couldn't know.
Yeah, exactly. The CSRF is quite easy and nice. That just puts a hidden input in with the token in and it's all taken care of for you. So that can be quite nice.
Yeah, excellent. All right. Schema.
So schema.
For APIs, right?
Yeah. So it's possibly the kind of more, I'll say modern, but I'm not sure if that's the word I mean. But yeah, so we, as an industry, we seem to have moved away from the forms of old and form data to sending JSON all the time, right? And Court schema is about saying, I expect this structure to arrive, validate it for me. So it's a very similar, it's very similar to Fast API, which I'm sure a lot of people know.
Okay. That's pretty interesting. So, like you say, very much like Fast API, it kind of brings in some frameworks called model binding, where you can say there's an argument and it's of this type, and then, you know, like a class, pedantic class or something along those lines, and it'll, here's a data class, and it'll take all the inputs, right? Query strings or route parameters, whatever, and parse them and map them in there, and then just give you an object and go, here, it's ready.
Yeah. So for this library, it supports, I've used all the documentation's data class, but it's pedantic based at the moment. And because of the it's not actually the typing, so there's no dependency injection or anything like that with FastAPI, but it uses the decorator validate request, and you pass it the model. And if the request that arrives can be turned into that structure and validated as such, then your function will be called and that'll be passed in as data. If it can't, then the client will get a 400 response.
Bad request, bad data.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. So validate request makes sense to me. It means like, here's your structured object that comes in, passed in as data. What's validate response?
So it's the same concept, but going back. So if you return like a to-do class instance itself, then there's no validation to do, right? You've already said it's the right structure. But often you'd return a dictionary or something like that, right? And expect it to go back as JSON. What this will do is it will say, I'll check that dictionary is of the right structure. And if it isn't, it throws a 500 response to the client and an error that you can go and view in whatever error monitoring tool you've got.
Sure. Okay, that's excellent. So I see you have data classes here, and you said it also works with Pydantic.
Yeah. So, well, actually, a shout out to one of your previous recent streams is I'm working on message spec support at the moment because I actually quite like that. So
message spec is interesting.
So it will support Pydantic and message spec. So you'll be able to use Pydantic data classes, attas, message spec stuff, or the message spec struct. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably all of it. But yeah, quite a bit of choice there.
The struct classes really, they've done some super interesting things here to make these data classes almost better for performance than even regular and for memory and stuff than regular Python classes. It's quite impressive.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Just for people who don't know, maybe just tell them real quick what message spec is. They probably know data classes in Pydantic.
Yeah. So much like data classes, and you can see here, it's a nice, simpler way of creating a class with various things created for you. But it also, much like Pydantic, will do validation when you try and if you use one of its functions to convert raw data like a dictionary into this type. And much like Pydantic as well, it also gives the ability to take this model and turn it into a open API JSON schema definition. And that's the final thing Quartz Schema does is once you've decorated all your routes, it will auto-generate a open API definition for you as well.
Oh, it will. Okay. Yeah. Using Swagger/docs. I think that's really nice. A lot of APIs just don't. They're like, we're not going to do that. Yeah, if they don't have something automated to do it. And having typed classes representing all your inbound and outbound data, pretty easy, right?
Yeah, I mean, it really helps with MyPy, right? Because instead of having like your request.data or something like that, which is some dict that, as far as MyPy concerns, can be anything, it must be a to-do instance in this function now. So yeah, really helps with your type checking.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, what do we got next? Sock. From Miguel Grimberg, Flask WebSockets.
This one there is an extension for, because this is one of the areas that Quart, being natively async, can just do itself. So a quarter, I think I describe sometimes as a superset of Flask, because it can do everything Flask can do,
the
and
C
a bit
plus
more.
Plus of Flask.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. So WebSockets solve a problem that websites generally have not been able to do. Like, once you make a request, usually there's the response and that's it. But what if the server, you want to send more stuff to the server. Server wants to send stuff out to you later. Like, I started this job 3 seconds later, now it's done. Or, you know, this bi-directional exchange is really cool. But a lot of times I feel like it's a little over the top. Like, a lot of times I think people maybe just want push notifications from the server and not true, like, let's have a conversation. Like, I just need to know when this happens. Just let me know as soon as it's done, right? So for that, go ahead.
Server sent events, seem to be not that well known, but yeah, probably describe your usage really well there.
That's exactly what I was getting at. So does Quart support SSE? Does it support server sent events?
Yeah. I think there's an extension for it, but in reality, it's a very small bit of code you need. So because you literally return a response with a certain header, and then you just return there's an example in the documentation for Quart, but you just return a certain data structure, and there you've got it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's when people say they want WebSockets, I think most of the time this is what they want. They want the client, the server to call the client sometimes, not just the other way around.
Yeah. So I'm going to go slightly off topic because it's something that interests me, but it's related to this. But one of the things I implement in Hypercon, because I find it really interesting, is that I think it must be 4 years ago, they introduced WebSockets for HTTP/2. And of course, one of the reasons you want WebSockets because the cost of opening a connection for HTTP/1 is fairly expensive. So you can keep it open and do the bidirectional. But with HTTP/2, you don't even need an extra connection anymore. You can have your WebSocket stream on the same connection as all your requests as well. So it's really nice and efficient. So yeah, I'd love to have an opportunity to make more use of it because I find it really interesting. But the code I write professionally at the moment doesn't quite need that level of real-time interaction.
So. I know. All the stuff I build, I'm like, that would be so fun. But, you know, I just don't need that.
Yeah, exactly.
I just have no use case. I mean, there are apps, I'm sure, that do it, right? Like really complicated single-page apps like StreamYard that we're using right now, for example. This has probably got some crazy interchange going on, but I don't write these kind of apps either. All right. Let's see. So the socket stuff, which is cool. That's, like you said, built into Qort. That's one of the advantages of it. But, you know, you can use Miguel Grinberg's stuff to add it to Flask. SQL Alchemy, you mentioned them before. Probably outside, if you're not in the Django space, it's not the only option for sure, but it is probably the de facto choice people, when they think, I want an ORM for a relational database, you probably start here, right?
Yeah, I think you would. Yeah. And this is a port, as I understand it, of the Flask SQL Alchemy extension to work with, or natively work with Qort. So should match all your expectations, I think. And if you're used to it, you just use this and it works with Qort and there you go.
Mm-hmm. Let's see an example here. You can set up your database with a pretty interesting nested type of construct here, like just, you know, passing rich arguments that take more. And if you look at the code on there, just the shape of the code is kind of unique here, but you end up with this constructed database thing, and then it has the base model class, and off you go, right? You just create a session from it, do all the things. I've always had mixed feelings about these things that you set up here that are built like into the web frameworks, potentially, that make them part of the request. Because if you're going to go and write little scripts that also do data stuff, you want to have, be able to get access to the data and the models over there as well. Although this looks like it does take the app there, but I don't know if it really needs a meaningful app. Like, I don't think that it would use it probably, but it just adds it to the request.
No, I don't think you need to be within an app context to use the DB. I may be wrong there, but yeah, I think you could probably use it in a script. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the only thing that concerns me about these like database helpers is like, you know, I need to do database stuff outside of a request as well. Even potentially some of the stuff that we're going to talk about in a minute, like it's just a background task that's not part of an actual request, but it could even still be in the web server process, right?
There's an extension called QuartDB, which is my preference because I prefer to write the SQL than go down the ORM route. And yeah, that works as you'd expect. You still set it up and pass it the app, which I think is true of this, but then you can just use it without an app context. It just basically it uses the app to get the configuration values so it knows where the database is.
Interesting. And now we're on to probably the biggest one that you want to talk about, which is quite exciting, Qort Tasks.
Yeah, so this is a very recent release that I haven't announced anywhere else yet. This is something, I think I read a post recently that said, for your web framework, you need like five things. Like you need a database connection, you need some kind of validation, input, output, rate limiting, authentication, and you need array to run periodic tasks. And in the past, my way to do this was extra infrastructure. So it was cron running somewhere or some kind of, I think cloud watch to some kind of event generator based on a cron schedule. And for me, that's just annoying because now I have to build extra infrastructure, which I don't need. I'm not at that scale.
Yeah. Maybe you got Celery or RabbitMQ or something like that, right?
Yeah, exactly. But again, with those, you need that extra infrastructure for it to work.
Yeah. It's another server. It's another thing that could get hacked. You got to patch it. You got to secure it. You got to know how to run it. It could go down and then none of your background stuff works anymore. It's all a hassle, even though it has a benefit.
Yeah. So what I really want to do is make use of the async event loop and just run a task in the background periodically. And obviously, at some point, this will normally only scale because I have so many background tasks, they dominate the server and stop it doing requests. But while I'm small and I'm starting out, this is just makes life so much easier.
Absolutely. It totally does. And because everything's async and await, you can just set up the task and just await the task. And it just blends in, hopefully, well with all the web requests, right?
Yeah, yeah. So for Qort tasks, if you write your task as an async def, then it will run it in the event loop. But if you write it as a def, it will run it on a thread. So if you have synchronous code that's going to block the event loop, like you're using traditional IO for want of a better phrase, then if you just use def, it will run it on a task, won't block your event loop, and you'll be fine. So yes, it's nice in that respect.
Yeah, and as long as your async pieces are fine-grained enough, you probably won't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just if you run a whole bunch of synchronous code or something like that, you might start to clog things up, but don't do that. Honestly, like what I find anyway on the web most of the time is you're talking to other things, talking to a database, talking to a cache, talking to an API. All those things are like perfectly suited for a wait because it's most of the time you're almost outside the web app.
Yeah. I think the perfect one for this that I keep thinking of is when you want to send a periodic email, like a reminder or a summary of the day, just write this decorated task run and you have your function that just sends the emails. That's why it exists for me. It makes that so much easier.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah. Like you say, just send out a quick email like, hey, I need to reset my password. All right, here, we're going to send you call an API like SendGrid or something like that. And we're going to send you, but you don't want to block things up. You just kick that onto the background work and off it goes. So one of the things that people would say, all right, you guys, I know you're excited about async, but we need durability. What if the server goes down? Or what if another potential issue is, what if you scale, like at least the cron stuff, like what if you fan out your web app into like 10 worker processes and you say, run in 5 seconds, and they all run in 5 seconds, 10 times, or, you know, those kind of issues here. So
this extension supports a couple of extensions to it. So you can pass it a custom store, which allows you to store when the task last ran. And so that means if the server goes down and it misses an invocation, then when it comes back up, it will recognize that and run the task straight away rather than wait till the next time. And the other thing it supports is you can decide what should happen before the task starts and what should happen after. So this allows you to put some locking in for your second case. In both cases, the reason it's not built in to quote tasks is you'll need to decide where you store this information, where do you store the lock, where do you store the... So usually a database works for that. So yeah, so you can add it all, but you've got to choose how yourself.
That's cool that it has placeholders and ways to plug that in. That's what I was thinking of, right? Like instead of just storing it in memory and throwing it on the queue, put it into the database and have the task just check the database and go, okay, I'm working on this one. No one else do this. We don't want to send 10 emails to the person. I got it, right? All that kind of stuff.
It's not a job queue, although I've been thinking about that recently. So yeah, it can't be like, it doesn't work in the sense that a job will run once. It will do jobs periodically.
Got it. Okay, so more of a scheduler type of thing. Mm-hmm. So I need to see if anyone's uploaded files to this location and then convert it from PNG to WebP or like save space. Or
you could be like, every morning I want to send out an email to the users and say, let's imagine it's a to-do app because everyone uses that as an example, and say, these are your tasks for the day or something like that.
Sure. If there are people who've signed up for the daily digest, send them their digest, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, very cool. And because it's on a background thread, it's not going to harm anything. Excellent. Okay, well, it looks pretty simple. Again, very decorator driven, right?
Yeah, so I mean, with all of these, the extensions, at least I've written, I've tried to follow the kind of Flask conventions, for better, for worse. So yeah. Same with Quart, it follows Flask.
Yeah, it feels like if you're already doing Flask or Quart, you just know what to do. It's just similar.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I think we've covered all the ones we explicitly said. Let's make sure we get a chance to cover those. I definitely want to encourage people to check out the Quart extensions page because there's quite a few more. Like, I'll see if maybe some jump out at me here that are kind of cool. Quart Bcrypt.
We briefly mentioned Quart DB, which is one I maintain, so I could say a bit more about that if you're so interested.
Yeah, sure. And it's hanging out right here on your list.
So this is much like the SQL Alchemy one. It's a way to connect to a database. But unlike the SQL Alchemy way, it doesn't promote an ORM. Rather, it just gives you connection that you can run SQL on. I know you can do that with SQL Alchemy. I mean, typically that's not what people do. So in this case, like the example here is you pass it the URL you want to connect to, and it supports Postgres and SQLite at the moment. And then in the routes, you have this g.connection object that you can make use of. And you can make use of that in background tasks. And it's quite easy to make use of it actually in Quart tasks as well. There's just a little snippet you need to do. But yeah, and that's it. You get a connection that you can do whatever you want with.
Yeah. Okay. Very nice way to just have everything set up, right? Like you don't have to worry about passing things around and create a transaction, go do your things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. We got Quart events for broadcasting server sent events and WebSockets. That's pretty cool.
There is one, yeah.
Yeah, another one that's cool is minifying all of your elements, right? CSS, JavaScript.
I've been doing that at the build stage a lot recently. there's a little snippet I can share if people want for Quart where you change the static function. So it will serve a gzipped version of the static file over the ungzipped one if the client will accept it. And yeah, then if you do it build time, because I think this one, and it might be a mistake, but I suspect it works at runtime. So it compresses at runtime.
It sounds like it does, yeah. Mm. It talks about doing it as a response, right? So yeah. Oh, it does have a cache though.
Ah, okay. Yeah, well, you get similar. Yeah, very similar to what I'm suggesting then.
Excellent. Now, those are really, really handy. If people go and they want to make their website better, check out, I guess, PageSpeed.
Mm. Oh, the Lighthouse.
Lighthouse is what I was going to call it. Yeah, but they renamed it to PageSpeed. So you can go put in and talk Python and see how we're doing. But it'll give you things like, how is your site fast enough? Let's see how the desktop one's doing, right? And it'll give you a score. And, you know, are we going to index you well, or are you going to be punished for having some kind of crappy experience? And this minification stuff that we're talking about can help there, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Similar to your DB, your Quart DB, we have Quart Motor, which is the async database access library for MongoDB. So I suspect it's super similar. I haven't used it because I use Beanie, which is like ORM style, so kind of on top of those things. Keycloak is interesting. Redis also is pretty interesting. Uploads. Let's finish it out with uploads, and we'll call it after that.
Okay.
So I haven't used this, but uploading files can always be a bit of a hassle, right?
It looks very similar to the Flask uploads one. So it's it's kind of a nice wrapper around how you get access to the files you've uploaded and what you do with them, kind of thing. Yeah,
that can be a little bit of a hassle, right? You got your request.files and all that. Don't know how to use this thing, but I know that people kind of struggle uploading files a lot, so that can be a thing.
I don't tend to actually write it that much, come to think of it, but yeah, it's just makes it easier.
Yeah, exactly. You know, profile pictures maybe is like that kind of stuff I'd be doing. Anyway, I guess I wrote some code that lets you upload MP3s at one point for podcasts, but I stopped using it, so it's not top of mind anymore. Anyway, excellent stuff here. I love just going through and seeing all these little pieces, these little building blocks you can bring together and just quickly build an app. So thanks for being on the show and telling everyone about it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, great. Hopefully opportunity to introduce some stuff that I hope people will find useful.
Yeah, and just more broadly, like thanks for working on Quart and pushing that forward.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, our aim is hopefully we're kind of going around in different ways of how we actually might merge Flask and Quart, but That's still the ultimate aim. I kind of think because of the limitations we were talking about earlier about running async code when you're deep in a sync code base, I think you'll always have to make a choice with Flask, where if you're going to be mostly sync, you go Flask. If you're mostly async, you go an async Flask or whatever it's called, which at the moment it's called Quart.
Mm-hmm.
We might be able to put them in the same code base perhaps, so then you can, you know, maybe mix and match, because you can You can certainly run Flask and Quart together with HyperCorn as the server and just have a what's called a dispatcher middleware layer in between that says for these routes it goes to Flask and for those routes it goes to Quart. So yeah, there are lots of ways to do it, but it depends what you want to do really.
Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe you could even create a different app. Instead of app equals Flask, it's app equals async Flask. Who knows?
That's effectively what Quart is. I mean, I called it async Flask at the start.
A Flask. Yeah. It ranks higher in the alphabetical sortings.
Yeah.
All right. So people are excited with Quart. Maybe it's back on their radar now that we've been talking about all these extensions. What do you tell them? How do they get started? What do they do?
Oh, I mean, you can just pip install Quart, and a quick start is as simple and familiar as it ever would have been for Flask. You just do app equals Quart and then app.get or app.whatever, and then your function below to handle it.
Yeah. The selling point is basically if you know Flask, you know Quart. You just use the word async some of the time.
Yeah. I mean, even the WebSocket support, I've tried to make it as familiar as you would be, as it would be if you had new Flask. So instead of using the global request, you now use the global WebSocket. So there's WebSocket.headers, and you can do WebSocket.send, send a message, that kind of stuff. So hopefully it just feels familiar.
Yeah, fantastic. I'm sure it does. And thanks for being on the show, and nice to have you back.
Thank you.
See you next time. Yeah, you bet.
This has been another episode of Talk Python to Me. Thank you to our sponsors. Be sure to check out what they're offering. It really helps support the show. This episode is sponsored by POSIX Connect from the makers of Shiny. Publish, share, and deploy all of your data projects that you're creating using Python. Streamlit, Dash, Shiny, Bokeh, FastAPI, Flask, Quarto, reports, dashboards, and APIs. POSIX Connect supports all of them. Try POSIX Connect for free by going to talkpython.fm/POSIT. POSIT. Want to level up your Python? We have one of the largest catalogs of Python video courses over at TalkPython. Our content ranges from true beginners to deeply advanced topics like memory and async. And best of all, there's not a subscription in sight. Check it out for yourself at training.talkpython.fm. Be sure to subscribe to the show. Open your favorite podcast app and search for Python. We should be right at the top. You can also find the iTunes feed at /iTunes, the Google Play feed at /play, and the direct RSS feed at /RSS on talkpython.fm. We're live streaming most of our recordings these days. If you want to be part of the show and have your comments featured on the air, be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at talkpython.fm/YouTube. This is your host, Michael Kennedy. Thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate it. Now get out there and write some Python code.